that we just need to love each other and be kind to each other and everything will be fine. And if that's the message that people are receiving, then they're missing out on the real message and they are in danger of missing out on God's real blessing that he's offering us. So this evening, what I really want to do is just look at the life of Christ and deal a blow to this false image of Jesus, meek and mild, without damaging the fact that he was meek and mild, but just with this understanding of it in the context of the extraordinariness of him being so meek and mild, given the root of who he was or who he is and his true identity as God. So the way I like to think of it is more as Jesus, gentle giant, like a tame lion kind of meek and mild, as opposed to meek to rhyme with weak, mild meaning powerless. So thinking of that then, thinking about the tame lion thing, has anyone seen the film The Lion King? I'm hoping some people have. You don't have to have seen it. Although if you haven't, you're getting a bit late. It's almost 30 years old now. But it's a film about, obviously, a lion. And eventually in the film, he becomes the king of the lions, okay? But oddly, he's not actually the king throughout most of the film. And at the beginning, he's just a cute little lion cub. He's small, he's innocent, he's fresh, he's a little bit arrogant. But because he knows that one day he's going to be the king. And at one point, he even makes this big song and dance of it. And he sings he's going to be a mighty king. And he gets all the other animals to join in. And they all comply. And they all do what he wants to do. And they join in this big song. And I guess there's a couple of reasons for that. The first one is, it is a musical. And the way it goes in musicals, everyone knows the song. And everyone joins in the dance number. And that's just how you move the plot along. But the other thing is, obviously, all these animals know that he is going to be the king one day, and they give him the respect, even though he's done nothing to deserve that respect yet. He hasn't shown who he's going to be as the king. And I guess we see, with the Nativity story, we see a similar thing happening with Jesus, although without the arrogance in there. You get all these people coming to pay their respects to this baby who so far in this world hasn't demonstrated who he is. He hasn't done anything. Yet, you know, he still gets his big musical number. The angels come, they come and sing, they declare his arrival. You get the shepherds coming to pay homage. So you get the shepherds who are Jews at the kind of the bottom of the social ladder. You then get these wise men, Gentiles, coming from a long way away also to come and pay their respects to this child. And what you see there is you get Jew, Gentile, and heavenly created. You get the low-born, the high-born, the heavenly created, all coming to pay their respects to this baby. And if we just stop there, you're kind of wondering, well, what happens next? Why are they coming to see this child? And if you do just stop at that nativity story at the end where everyone's come and said, paid their respects, then you're going to miss out. A bit like if you start at the beginning of The Lion King, you get 15 minutes in and then you go, well, that was nice, just stop there. So what happens next then? Who does the baby become and what does he do? One of the earliest stories of Jesus' life that we see in the Gospels is in the temple. He's about 12 years old and he's talking to the priests and the scribes and they're marveling about how great his understanding is of the scriptures, even at that age. But then later on, when he starts his ministry, he starts preaching in Nazareth. And they say to themselves, is this the carpenter's son? As if in all that time he hasn't actually been speaking and acting in the way that he did in the temple. he's been essentially hiding his nature there, not coming across as his true self, being essentially humble and being that meek and mild person in Nazareth. So you can see he is being meek and mild here. But then the next part of the story, we can understand that better in the context if we remember the temptations in the desert. So if you remember, Satan takes Jesus up to the top of the temple and he says, well, look, you know, throw yourself off here and the angels will come and rescue you and you'll be fine. And so if we're to understand that as a real temptation, it must have been true that if he had thrown himself off, the angels would have saved him because it wasn't yet his appointed time to die. And we see back in Nazareth now, when he does preach to these people and they marvel at what he's saying, he then says a few things that just cut a little bit too close to the bone to these people, and it upsets them. And they get so angry with him that they want to drive him out of Nazareth, and they drive him out of town, and they want to throw him off a cliff. And how does he deal with them? He could allow them to throw him off the cliff. We've seen that the angels would have come and rescued him. He could have perhaps prayed to God and said, look, to his father and said, look, I'm surrounded by my enemies. These people are sinful. They're not going to repent. Just let them take the wages of their sin now. And they would have died. We see in Numbers where Israel doesn't follow God's ruling that he often then brings them plagues. So we could see that Jesus could have easily called down a plague on these people. It would have been perfectly in keeping with what had previously been done with Israel. But he doesn't. What does he do? He just passes through in the midst of them. Which, you know, in itself is quite miraculous because obviously it's quite a crowd. They're all pressing around. They want to kill him, but he just passes through the midst of them. He doesn't bring judgment on them. And so he does act in a very mild and merciful way with them. That's true. The next thing I want to think about is back to those temptations when he's turning stones into bread. Or he's being told, you know, you're hungry, why don't you take these stones and turn them into bread? Obviously he doesn't do it, but if we were to understand that as a true temptation, it must have been perfectly possible for him to do that. And these days, understanding science, we realize that the stones were probably mostly made of silicon. And Satan's saying to him, look, take this thing that is mostly made of silicon and turn it into bread, which is mostly made of carbon. And we know that that's not possible to do. That's like alchemy. You can't do it. You know, the only place scientists understand that the only time that kind of thing can be done is in the center of a star. It's something we haven't actually observed because you can't do it, but it is essentially creation power. So you see that Jesus had in his hands at the time the power of creation. Another time you see him in his great power is when he's calling the disciples. In each of the times when you see that people are being called, they're doing something else. So they're working with their family, they're cleaning their nets, some of them, and Jesus just walks up to them and says, come, follow me. Now, I don't know about any of the rest of you, but if somebody I didn't know just came up to me in the middle of my work and said, come and follow me, I'd at least question them and say, who are you? I almost certainly wouldn't do it straight away, but in the Bible records, that's what they did do. And it's just very difficult to imagine that you would do that, isn't it? Because you've got your family, they're relying on you, and somebody comes up to you and says, come, follow me, and you just go and do it. It seems unlikely, and it's just demonstrating that he has the power of a king, of a true king, where if you have a true king and they tell you to do something, you would do it because they are the king. Another example is the story of Lazarus, which we read about in John 11. Jesus hears his friend Lazarus is very ill, and he's called to come and see to him, and he arrives, what everybody thinks is several days too late. Lazarus is now dead, and buried, and he's been buried for several days. And so Jesus says, open the tomb. Not really coming across as particularly meek and mild at that point. And then Martha, the sister of Lazarus, says, are you sure? It's going to be really quite stinky at this point. And he says, just trust me and open the tomb. This doesn't feel like somebody who's particularly meek and mild at this point, does it? How many people would say to the brother or sister of somebody who's just died, I want to see them just reopen their grave. I don't care if they're partly rotting, as that's going to be how people think at that point. It's not that meek and mild. And then the next thing he does is he says to the dead man, come out. And Lazarus obeys. He does. And so you see, he's got power over life itself. Another example in his life is in the middle of the storm, and he calms the storm. He's on a boat with a bunch of people, many of whom are fishermen, who are going to have been used to storms. And what happens? They're afraid. The storm is so bad, they feel like they're going to die. What's Jesus doing? He's asleep. And when they wake him up and they say, Jesus, we're going to die. How does he react? Yes, he does react meekly and mildly, I guess, doesn't he? He says, calm down. And they're still panicking, and so he says to the storm, be still. He's essentially shushing a storm. And yes, I guess in a way you could say, yes, he is doing it meekly and mildly, because it's not recorded that he shouts at the storm. He just says, be still. So you see, he's got the power over nature. Nearly my final example in this run of his life is when he comes into the temple and he sees people selling in the temple when they shouldn't be. This gets him angry in a righteous way, and what does he do? He says they've turned it into a den of thieves, and then he drives them out. He drives them out, and he gets all these people out of the temple. This doesn't seem like a meek and mild act at this point. That's like somebody coming in here, telling us we're all doing something wrong, and then driving us out. What happens if you are doing something wrong and you're confronted by somebody who's calling you a thief? Are you likely to just do what they say? Probably not. You'd probably fight back. But in this case, there isn't anything recorded about the people fighting back or pushing back. There isn't anything recorded about a bit of argy-bargy between Jesus' disciples and everybody else. He shouts at them, you den of thieves, and he drives them out, and they all just do it. This isn't meek and mild. This is, again, showing you he's got this huge power of command over these people. What is mild in the way that he treats them is, in a way, he does treat them with great mercy. Again, we see time and again in the Old Testament where Israel fails, or a portion of Israel fails, and you see people swallowed up into the earth or plagued. In this case, all he's done is he's driven them out. He's given them a chance. Finally then, at the cross, given everything we've just looked at, you know, he could have got out of it in very many ways, very powerfully. You know, when people came to arrest him in the garden, we've seen that he can get out of a crowd by walking through their midst. He doesn't. He just goes with them. Yes, at that point, I guess, he goes with them meekly. You see, in his trial, a great many times in his life, he gets out of what might be difficult situations with just a few words of wisdom. In this case, what does he do? Nothing. He stays silent. When he's on the cross, he was mocked by people, and he said, you call yourself the King of the Jews? Well, get down off the cross then. Do it for yourself. And given everything that we've just looked at, you've got to believe that that wasn't just a mocking time. That was a real temptation. He could have got himself off of that cross, but he didn't. And given that we've seen that he's got that creative power, when he's there being beaten by the soldiers, and when they're driving the nails through his arms, don't you think it's possible he could have turned his skin into something as hard as rock, that would have turned those nails, that would have taken away the pain. He could have avoided all of that. But he doesn't. He takes it. He takes it for us. He suffers for our sake. This is not meek and mild behavior here, is it? It's taking on all this pain for our sake. If you look at armies, people who do that kind of thing are given the highest honors, the best medals. And you wouldn't look at somebody who had won a Victoria Cross and particularly think they were meek and mild, would you? Not given what they've done and the sacrifices they've made. So I want to just say these aren't really meek and mild actions in their own. They're more holding back his real power, treating people gently, even though they don't deserve it. Going back to the story of the Lion King, okay? Later on in the story, he gets run out of town by his uncle, who kills his father and takes over as king. In this case, Simba, the Lion King, is a baby and he can't fight back. Later on, he grows up, he returns, and he takes his rightful place as king. His uncle underestimates him, and at that point, he loses his life. And I guess there's a similarity here with Christ. If you underestimate him, if you forget everything we've just seen as Christ as the adult, and you underestimate him, then you miss out on life, which is what he's offering us. Without understanding him as the God King, you miss out on his central message and what he came to do. And you know, he's came to tell us that people are sinful and we die because of it, and we are cut off from God. And we understand it's obviously so important that Jesus came as to be God and man himself here to die for us. That was the whole central part of what he was doing here. It wasn't just to teach us how to be, but he came to die, to take that punishment that we deserve on himself. He rose again. He reigns in heaven now as our king. And all we need to do to receive his forgiveness is ask for it, believe and trust in him and acknowledge him as the king. And that's what we're celebrating at Christmas, not necessarily this story about a baby, but we're celebrating Jesus redeeming love for us. That's what we're celebrating now. It's what we're celebrating at Easter. It's essentially what we're celebrating every time we come together as Christians. But I guess none of this is new. I'm not saying anything I would hope that most Christians have not heard before. So what are we going to take from this? Well, Christians, really, it's. I would hope this just gives you something to equip you to be a light in the world, as we've just read about before, when Ben read for us, and to take the opportunity, if it arises, to carry the message at Christmas beyond the baby part of the nativity into the real power of Christ that that the nativity is the precursor to. For non-Christians, whether you're here today or listening to this on the internet, it's really to challenge your beliefs and understanding of Christ. You know, this time of year, that non-threatening little cute baby image is a wonderful comfort to those who are perishing, to those who aren't saved. And you know, if you do want to consider Jesus as the adult, then at the very best, some people might say, you know, well, he was just a good teacher. He was a prophet who came to show us the way. And that's a lie. And like all good lies, it is based on a nugget of truth. He did come and show us the way. But if we read in Matthew 5, verse 21, it says, this is Jesus speaking, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.' But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire." Who can manage that? Really, who can manage to live their life without being unjustly angry at people? I challenge you to go for a drive for like 5 hours and see if you can manage not to be angry at somebody. You know, who manages their first few years without lying? You know, when I was a child, apparently my parents said to me, because somebody had nibbled on the communion bread before it had got to the church, and the teeth marks were about those of a five-year-old, and I was the only five-year-old in the house. And they said, "Tim, did you eat the bread?" And I said, "No, it was the bread eater." Now, obviously, as a five-year-old, I thought I was being quite clever, but it was a very, very transparent lie. And so, you know, you can see then that if you say that Jesus was just a prophet who came to show us the way, then yes, he's showing us the way, but what it's doing and his, you know, what he's saying here and through his actions only serves to condemn us all the more. There is no way that we can live up to the way that he's given us here. Not on our own. We can't do it, and so we are isolated from God. Thankfully, if we turn to John 3:17, I guess that sums up why we're not condemned. If you just read, "For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God. And this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people loved the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come into the light, lest his works should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God." I think in the light of what we read in Matthew, this is such a wonderful thing to see, that he hasn't come to condemn, but to save. And I think it shows that he isn't just a prophet come to show us the way, but he has come to save us. As we're coming to Christmas then, I guess non-Christians at this point might say, "Well, you Christians are always talking about sin, aren't you? Why are you bringing it into this message now? Why are you ruining my Christmas by talking about sin?" Well, you know, we've already seen that the whole purpose of Jesus' life was to rescue us from sin. It's central to the Christmas story. And we only have to look at the hymns and the carols that we sing when we think about the modern way of, you know, celebrating Christmas and these carols. If you think of "Hark the Herald Angels," which we'll sing shortly, the words are, "Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King, peace on earth and mercy mild, God and sinners reconciled." That point was so important that the writers have put that right at the beginning of that hymn, in pride of place. Think about that first verse. It's essentially what I've just been saying to you now. So, you know, just saying that if you're celebrating Christmas and you want to sing the carols, just listen to the carols, listen to the words. People are writing these carols 200 odd years ago, which is probably about the foundation of where we think of our modern way of celebrating Christmas comes from. They knew it. They knew the message. They knew that it was about God and sinners being reconciled. So, finally then, it's a final challenge. If you haven't accepted Christ as your Saviour, are you going to dismiss him as a meek baby? Or will you acknowledge his power? Will you think about what we've looked at today and realise that he is God? Do you want to know him and have a restored relationship? Because if you do, all you have to do is acknowledge him as King. So let's keep Christmas about Christ the King, not the baby. Because you can dismiss him, but he is still King of Kings. As we read just now in Philippians verses 10 and 11, I'm going to paraphrase, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess he is Lord. I guess that leads us to our final hymn, which is Hark the Herald Angels.